Welcome to the Invisible Capital Podcast with PitchBook, where we shine a light on the traditionally opaque private markets. Here are your hosts, Adley Bowden and Adam Lewis.
Welcome, everyone, to the Invisible Capital Podcast. We're devoting season one to discussing the work of PitchBook analysts and writers during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Adam Lewis, and I'll be joined today by Adley Bowden, along with emerging tech analyst Ryan Vaswani. What's going on, guys?
Good to be here. I'm excited.
Welcome, Ryan. I miss our desk row. Fun fact for listeners. Back in the office days, it was you and I on a desk row of desks. Properly social distance, but I'm not rushing back there.
Yeah, I was thinking that, actually. I was like, it's possible we can maintain our power row with the gap in the middle.
Yeah,
we were doing social distancing before it was a thing. So,
yeah, well, thanks for joining. The note you published is a phenomenal look at some of the effects of COVID-19 into some of the various industries and landscapes. And we're going to make available to everybody. And right now it's only to clients, but we're going to make it available as part of you joining the podcast. But I think it'd be helpful if you just give readers a quick overview of the segmentation and kind of the thesis you use to just attack this note.
So I think what kind of spawned this was a sense of urgency, right? As soon as the pandemic was kind of really making itself known throughout the world, you know, there's an immediate urgency for information, right? So I think one of the things I wanted to do with this note was to really better understand, okay, what is actually happening with the pandemic response? Specifically, first on the healthcare side, that's really where my mindset started off with this note. And that led me into, you know, a deep dive into what's happening with testing, treatments, you know, vaccines, and then some of the underlying technology that hospitals and laboratories are using for certain discoveries. And then kind of extending from there, you know, I kind of got drawn in also curiously to what's happening on the economic side of things, right? So the second half of the note is very dedicated to, hey, who are the key industries that are actually able to you know, kind of cushion the economic effects of the pandemic? And why are they, you know, uniquely positioned to do so relative to other industries, for example? So yeah, that was kind of the, I guess, synthesis of the note. And yeah, it led to a lot of interesting topics that I'm excited to talk more about.
Ryan, you covered a lot of verticals and industries in this note. Were there any in particular that jumped out to you?
Yeah, for sure. So I think one of the coolest things that kind of stuck out to me is that in any of sort of the segments that I've laid out in the note that you look into, there's at least one, if not multiple, emerging technologies that are basically primed to make a huge impact in the space, right? And maybe just even to quibble with the language a little bit is I had as well sort of thought, okay, what's being developed? What new technology is sort of arising? But I think really what you see and what led to the title of the note, Accelerating History, is that many of these technologies were already thought of before the pandemic. And so what you're seeing is that there's simply a greater amount of investment, obviously focus on these technologies. And I think that's one of the coolest things that's happening. So looking into each of those segments individually, I mean, starting with testing, one of the hottest areas right now is CRISPR. CRISPR is primarily known for its kind of gene editing prowess, and only recently, you know, has it really been tailored more towards diagnostics. And so obviously, if you think to the whole, I think testing actually is probably one area that people are maybe most familiar with, even if not the details, of course, just the media narrative and how slow it's been, you know, the idea that, okay, it's taken us months and months to finally get to a situation where, you know, at least in the United States, we do have a significant amount of testing now. And even then, the testing results and the process for different individuals in different states is wildly different, right? And I think historically, what you see is an issue with speed. And actually, that's a common theme as I discuss some more of these technologies, is speed is a huge area that all of these technologies are improving. So traditional testing, even if you can get an appointment, you know, with your primary care physician, you take a swab, you take a test, they probably still have to send it to a lab. And then that lab may take 24 to 72 hours to process that test, get the results back to your doctor, and then, you know, they can obviously communicate that to you, right? with you look at something like CRISPR diagnostics, that is very focused on point of care testing. And so you will still have to go to a primary care physician, for example, although some of them actually are over the counter. They're really trying to work on that as well. But those are tests that can be done in under an hour, and some of them really just 15 minutes. It's actually quite amazing. And in fact, you know, some of the creators of the test are really trying to liken it and brand it, you know, almost like an over-the-counter pregnancy test is really, I think, what they want to target. So that's an area that just, you know, speed and honestly affordability too. The technology, you know, once it's improved a little bit more, is definitely can reasonably, you know, be scaled to lots of individuals.
So to take that, for people who haven't read the note yet, you dive into this. Can you maybe just give a background on how you took that as a segment? What type of research went into identifying that as its unique segment? And then the companies behind the different solutions being put towards improving testing?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So to answer the question about like why I chose that as a segment, again, I was kind of in this mindset of what are the key aspects of the healthcare response, you know, the government's trying to organize, what are the key aspects of that response that are actually going to get us out of this pandemic, right? You know, that's the question everyone wants to understand. What are the steps out of this mess, in a sense, right? And when I was looking, you know, at the research, and I was, you know, just reading articles, you know, trying to basically, survive the information fire hose, I think what kind of revealed itself naturally was that, again, there are three key areas that healthcare providers are trying to target. So the first is this segment of diagnostics or testing. And this is just the notion that for a proper public health response, you need to be able to understand, you know, who is actually infected, right? And where those populations are. So that's one big reason that we've put so much effort into testing. The second segment that kind of stems from that is if you are infected, if you do get the virus, you know, what are the treatments available to you, right? And then after that, of course, the long-term play is vaccines. Of course, that's the ideal target, is if we can get a vaccine, you know, that's really the last step, I think, out of the pandemic. And then underlying all of that, my last segment is really just the continuity of, you know, a hospital and laboratory and some public health technology. So those are solutions on the healthcare side that they really stretch across all phases, you know, from the moment the pandemic started to the moment it ends. We're going to need, you know, proper hospital technology solutions and laboratory tech to, again, expedite the research.
So how'd you go about finding, you named some specific companies in the research note. It's in the market map. It's linked even into the platform. The PitchBook platform with searches. How'd you find those companies?
Yeah, totally. So I had a pretty exhaustive system where, you know, it was a series of Google News alerts. I had trend. I honed in on a couple of key, you know, topics and kind of keyword searches. But essentially, my method was very much just, okay, here's the topic, whether it be diagnostic testing, and obviously, you know, diagnostic testing related to COVID. And then I kind of just did a deep dive on the internet, again, Google News, of course, using, you know, PitchBook where I could to surface, you know, additional information. But really just understanding, like, what are these companies' solutions and how are they helping? And I think what's cool, too, is, again, getting to the urgency back to that topic, just the notion of, you know, the government, whether it be public health agencies, foreign governments, international organizations, there is just an insane amount of information available on all these sorts of companies that are, you know, again, providing solutions. And that was immensely beneficial. You know, anytime I had a question about like, oh, what is the technology, or who are the companies that are specifically developing, at-home testing, you know, I think there's just an immense amount like on the web that I was able to access.
Ryan, from your research, what did you find in terms of like which companies are making the most progress in getting a more accurate test? Because in the news, you see over and over again, you know, there are all these false positive tests, and
totally,
you know, sometimes the percentage is like less than 50%, and you just
totally.
Yeah, it's just, it's a huge worry. But I imagine that all these companies that you wrote about are, you know, putting so many resources towards making the actual testing process more accurate.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for sure, too, not to go in depth, but there were some FDA, you know, bumps in the beginning that certainly, I think, hampered progress at that time. Those have since, I think, been largely ironed out. And what you're seeing is the FDA providing a lot of like emergency use authorizations for lots of different types of tests. To go back to CRISPR briefly, that is one reason a lot of people are excited about it, is the sensitivity of the test, you know, the accuracy is something that is very favorable relative to its peers, you know, again, if perfected. And by the way, I should mention that like Sherlock Biosciences is the first of the CRISPR diagnostics to actually receive FDA emergency use authorization for their test. And I think Mammoth Biosciences is right behind them. I don't believe they have it yet, but they're coming up. But yeah, to answer your question, I mean, it's really a variety of solutions. And again, that's another similar theme that pops up in this, but the traditional test that I described where you have to send to a lab and it takes 24 to 72 hours, you know, being sort of, you know, I guess I don't want to call them antiquated because obviously still being used today, but the old fashioned method of sorts, the problems with those have been known for a long time. And now if you look at, again, the variety of companies working on the point of care testing, the rapid diagnostics, they all, I think, show promise for high accuracy. And again, the last idea here is just that it's important to pursue a variety of solutions, and it's not going to be an environment where one company, you know, even Sherlock in the CRISPR space, is going to dominate testing across the world or across the United States.
You're going to see that point. Yeah. How's investment been looking into this space?
Yeah. So pandemic response, especially again, testing, even the other segments, you are seeing a lot of investment across the space, both, you know, historically, but obviously extremely accelerated through the last 6 months. And one of the coolest things is you're seeing a lot of government funding. So maybe to even just jump segments slightly here, but I know the German government, I believe, put a like 300 million pound investment into a company called CureVac. And you know, I can kind of discuss that because they work on mRNA vaccines, which is a company Moderna is very famous for on the public side. But you've seen this another organization in the United States is the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness. I think there's an I in there too. I think it's CEPI. But they were founded for this exact moment in time. And actually looking at CEPI's investments has been fascinating because they had already funded before the pandemic organizations like CureVac and like Moderna and have since, I believe, contributed additional funding. But yeah, I mean, there's clearly a, you know, a lot of excitement about the solutions these companies are poised to provide. And I think you've seen the general investment kind of skyrocket as, again, the urgency of the problem has become clear.
Yeah, I gotta say, I like your overall optimism just talking about the space after reading so many negative headlines in the media for the past, you know, 3 months about testing problems and, you know, all the different issues that these companies are going through. But it seems like there's actually been some improvement.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, in a moment, of maybe political cynicism globally, I think it's fascinating to kind of live in a moment of global cooperation. And you know, whether it's happening across the world or not, I think, again, there's always room for improvement. I think you legitimately do, in the science community, especially in the public health community, have an amazing, and especially in the technology and business community, have an amazing moment of global cooperation happening right now. And again, when you simply look at these solutions, the variety that are being tested or deployed, it simply does not happen without that, level of cooperation. So starting from, you know, I'll say it, starting from the Chinese sequencing the virus, you know, way back in whatever it was, January, February, sending that code out and then the rest of the world having that genetic code to work off of and running from there. Pretty cool stuff.
So you've got a whole second half of the note and perhaps one of the more analyst-esque sentences. I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Oh boy.
From your note, the second part of the note focuses on digitization and automation.
Totally.
Companies mitigating the economic externalities of the virus by providing new technologies to meet new enterprise and consumer demands.
There you go.
You unpack that?
Yeah.
What are you trying to say in a little more plain English?
That one was for my dad. I know my dad would be proud of that one. he's the academic in our family for sure. So there's a lot there, of course. So in understanding, right, the economic effects, right, the knock-on effects of the virus, what I really want to understand is what types of companies, right, like what are the patterns that represent companies that are either thriving, you know, if they can, which maybe not many companies can do that, or at least at the very least surviving, right? And I think that you get to this theme of adaptability, right? Specifically adaptability through technology. i.e. if you look at the companies that are poised to succeed in a post-COVID world and have already seen some, you know, gains during the pandemic, they're companies that have strategically deployed technology in ways that allow them to continue their business through the interruptions, right? So I even note maybe briefly, but, you know, it's worth noting that, of course, this is not even an option for certain industries. You know, I have friends that work in the hospitality, you know, food service industry here in Seattle. You know, unfortunately, you know, some of those industries, there's really almost nothing that you could do, at least immediately, right? If we can't all actually go to restaurants, if we can't all, you know, be face to face, obviously travel, you know, consumer transportation, things like that have been impacted. So instead, you know, I focused on like, okay, if you look at something like remote work, obviously that's, you know, where we all are at in this moment. I'm sure most of us listen to this podcast. So, you know, I wanted to focus on, okay, how are companies digitizing traditionally analog operations within the company such that they can continue their workflows relatively seamlessly into the future, right? And on the automation side, more, okay, you know, that obviously looks a little bit more at manufacturing, definitely logistics as well. But where can those sort of companies, you know, automate processes whereby they don't necessarily need workers, you know, on the factory floor, or if they do, in a very limited capacity where they can ensure social distancing. So that's what the heart of what I was getting at there with that. That's that crafted sentence.
Yeah, certainly. I would say your explanation was 10 out of 10 there. I think your dad will be proud. What are the possibilities for ed tech, education technology? It seems like, you know, so many parents' worlds have been upended, including Adley's. And there's been a lot of progress, I guess, over the past 5 or 6 years in moving towards, you know, digitizing, in your words, a lot of educational tools. But has that process also been accelerated by COVID-19?
The short answer is no. And I think that if you look at a lot of analysis, you look at a lot of commentary coming out of the education space today, the general consensus is that remote work was largely a failure. And this isn't necessarily to put the onus specifically on technology solutions. You know, I think it's more just the reality that teachers and administrations had to pivot very quickly. I mean, you literally had teachers in a period of a week going, I have many teachers actually, very close friends here in Seattle, and they literally had to, you know, go from teaching the classroom on Friday, they got the next week off as the school tried to figure out what it was trying to do, and then the following Monday, they were on a Zoom call with their students, right? And no one really understood that environment, you know, even a few months in as schools are winding down, and I think most of them have finished, teachers are still, you know, sort of like, wow, what are we going to do in the fall, right? Mm-hmm. So when you look at the ed tech kind of opportunity and considerations, I think moving forward, I think one reality is that like technology is definitely a supplement, but not a replacement. And I think that that's always been true, but it's only more emphasized kind of in the pandemic environment. I really focus on, you know, direct-to-consumer offerings. I think those have a lot of promise. Again, especially as kids remain home and parents look for either additional activities or, again, supplements to help their child's education. You have a lot of companies, whether it be learning subscription boxes for early education, whether it be additional tutoring services online, but you have a lot of ed tech companies that are specifically targeting parents. And I think that's very smart, especially as parents become, you know, a more important, whether they like it or not, a more important, you know, factor in their child's education at this point. And then the other piece that I'd really highlight is reskilling and upskilling for corporations and individuals. But obviously, you know, with so many people out of work, either furloughed or laid off, I think for those individuals, they are looking for opportunities to upskill, specifically because some of those jobs, frankly, either won't come back at all or will come back very slowly. So some cool things that I've seen, for example, there's this organization called Guild Education, and they've actually partnered with some companies in the food service space, so like Chipotle and Taco Bell, and they actually help those companies increase education benefits so that they can specifically take coding classes or, you know, various, you know, upskilled types of education classes simultaneously, you know, kind of benefiting those companies to help, you know, with, you know, retaining, you know, talent and attrition and things like that. And then the other area I'd point out is just MOOCs, which, you know, is like massive open online courses. And mm-hmm. those, although historically targeted towards higher education, are actually pivoting quite a bit towards corporations as companies try to realize, okay, we need to reskill some of our workforce as the pandemic changes the economy, right? As new skills become more or less valuable. And so I think you see a growth in like educational stipends being used for online courses so that employees can, you know, really make sure they're competitive into the next generation.
All of this just reinforces my thesis that we are all going to be controlled by Skynet here in the next 5 to 6 years. I mean, grocery stocking robots, like who trusts that? It's quite disturbing to think about. I don't know. Maybe exciting for some. I don't know. Totally. The less automation for me, the better.
Yeah, that's very fair. Like that. It's accelerating trends, you know, we'll see. Some will thrive and some will definitely not, but.
What are the next verticals that you're going to be writing about, Ryan?
I'd say what I'm actually most excited to explore, especially going back to the idea of emerging technologies, is decarbonization, specifically under the umbrella of climate tech. So, you know, though we've been so focused on the pandemic, you know, the climate is still a major issue, right? Even though we got a slight reprieve in carbon emissions, you know, in February and March. And so I'm really excited to look at that space. And again, especially on the emerging technology side, there's some amazing technologies, whether it be carbon capture, some insane improvements happening in hydrogen or chemical battery storage. There's just a variety of areas that I'm excited to explore that are kind of showing how we can maybe, fingers crossed, reach the Paris climate goal.
Awesome. Well, we will certainly look forward to that over the next few months. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us for today's episode.
For sure. Thanks for having me.
As always, you can go to pitchbook.com/podcast for the show notes and other relevant materials. I'm Adam Lewis.
And I'm Adley Bowden. Please rate, review the podcast on whatever platform you're using to listen to it. The reviews always help out in others discovering what we're building. And as always, thanks for listening to this episode of PitchBook's Invisible Capital Podcast.